Welcome to Front Row Geeks, episode 3. And this is the second time I'm recording this because, Dad, if you were paying attention to right here, and if you were listening to the podcast like I told you, you would realize that the first time I did this, recorded this, I said episode 4. Why didn't you say something? I asked you to pay attention. So I did all this work with saying episode 4, all that editing, only in the end to realize that I had said episode 4 when in fact this is episode 3.
Good, you got it straight now.
Yeah, it's a big learning experience. That I wish you were there with me when I did this.
Well, sorry.
I hope in the future you can be there for me. Like, sure. Like I will be on your deathbed.
Sure.
Jeez. So I have to explain again that this is episode 3 of the Front Row Geeks podcast. Important because in this time we interviewed Rob Hicks of Spiral Inc. Comics. We went to Phoenix Comic Con over this last weekend and we had a sit down with him and talked to him. Invited him over and gave him some drink, some water, delicious water. Some stuff from Nature Box. I don't think he had any though. He had a little bit maybe. But he definitely had the water that I brought. Thank you for sponsoring the water, Dad. That was you. Thank you. So, yeah. Rob Hicks, great guy, by the way. Indie comic developer. And he was good to us. Very gracious. Very thankful that we had him on. And, I mean, we were thankful to have him on. Yeah. You know, busy. He was working the conference all day. And then at the end, at like 8 o'clock at night, he still came and talked to us. So, thank goodness he did. So we had a really good talk. So I hope everyone enjoys it. Thanks everyone who's been subscribing and listening. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you for listening. And I hope you listen to the future ones. Because we're going to have a lot more than the one I'm having here just right now. We're going to have a lot more coming up. And speaking of a lot more, David. I wasn't going to use his name. Which I did write in the first recording. But now I did. I don't feel like doing it over again. Astro Omega is going to do Twitch streaming. So go to Twitch, search for Front Row Geeks, and you'll find him. He usually does Friday nights, Arizona time, 7 p.m. But I think we have an extra episode this week on Wednesday, about same time. So keep your Twitch open for that, Wednesday night or Friday night of this week, December 17th or December 19th. I'll be busy December 19th because that's my dad's birthday. We're going to do something fun, right? And you're probably going to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah. I hope everyone enjoys today's episode of Rob Hicks of Spiral Inc. Comics. Visit him his website, spiralincomics.com. Check out his stuff. It's pretty good. And enjoy the show.
Welcome to Front Row Geeks.
Neil Adams, I mean, huge. That guy's been around for years, you know.
And then Eddie McClintock.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what was his works on, because I know you're telling me about him, but I'm bad with names. You know I'm bad
Top
with names.
Gun.
Oh. Oh.
Tom Skerritt.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
That okay. Sorry. I'm really bad with names and like there's
I'm the same way.
Unless like you're like fully immersed in them and you follow them like and you read their Wikipedia page like 10 or 15 times, like only at that point it's like okay, I know who you are now. It registers and
yeah, I'm excellent with faces. Like I remember a face, but like names, so. But yeah, they pulled some pretty big celebrities. They had all the Doctor Who people there and. Blair Adams was there, you know, the Exorcist chick.
I think I saw that she has a session tomorrow. Unless I read that wrong, there's a session tomorrow.
Yeah.
And we're debating about taking a visit on that and see what's up with that.
Yeah.
I don't know what she's going to talk about, but I mean, anything that
knows.
that'll will probably be worth listening to.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm not starstruck when it comes to the TV celebrities and movie celebrities and stuff. I mean, it's just kind of whatever for me with those guys. But if they pull in some big name comic book guys, I'm more than likely to geek out over them than the TV people. But PCC, they always have, you know, pretty big names coming in for their stuff. So
wasn't this year they had John Rhys Davies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was there for Phoenix Con back in June. Yeah, so they had some. Hell, Danny Glover was there this year.
Oh, he what? Yeah. Oh, that would have been.
Yeah.
Did not know.
You guys missed Danny Glover.
I missed that one. Well, I've actually never been to a Phoenix Comic Con before. I've just been kind of stuck in Tucson as far as that stuff goes.
Yeah. I did 2013.
Okay.
Yeah. And that one.
No, they bumped it up a lot this year. Yeah, because what they did differently this year is they put the celebrities up on the second floor, so they weren't taking up floor space for the vendors and everything, and they expanded the vendor space and got some bigger names in there. So,
because they were pushing a lot of those names in the ads and website when I was registering.
They had the Green Arrow guy there. They had pretty much all the hot people that's on TV right now. They had a lot of them there. So.
Do you catch any of the Arrow show they have in the CW?
Yeah, no, I mean I know of it. I haven't sat down and watched any of them. You know, I'm not a big Green Arrow fan. I'm more likely to watch the new Flash series than Green Arrow. You know what I mean? Because that looked pretty good. But
I only started watching those series during the last Thanksgiving break that we had a while ago. Mm-hmm. I was in Vegas for a week, so just between Vegas stuff and mm-hmm. being in the hotel room, I just like started binge watching this. Yeah. Someone said, "Hey, give us a try." It's like, "Well, okay, I got time." And then, you know, you press play, and then you know, 6 a.m. the next morning. Oh, it's time. I probably should go to sleep sometime.
Yeah, probably should get some kind of sleep. Yeah.
Yeah. So I marathoned. I binge watched all of Arrow and The Flash. And both of those looking like they're really hitting it big for that network.
Arrow's been, you know, people are freaking out over Green Arrow, and then. Flash looks like it's pretty good, so I'll do the same thing. I'll sit down at some point when I get free time and binge watch all the Flash and catch up on that, because they just did a crossover.
A couple weeks ago.
Flash crossover, yeah. So
yeah, it's nice that I got in at that point. It feels like, because like for years I've been hearing about Arrow. Well, people like Arrow, and I used to watch Smallville when it was on that same channel, and I was there for the whole time, and in my own bubble of viewing it, I liked it. It was good. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how big it was until they started people started talking about the finale.
Smallville got up to like 10 seasons or something like that, didn't it? Yeah, I fell off of Smallville after about season 3. Like, I was just kind of done with the whole thing. So, yeah.
That was definitely a grounds for experimentation. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean, I like to show well enough throughout the run, and I'm just kind of glad that they gave it a chance, because now we get to take chances with all these other ones.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, they're doing the TV show stuff, right? I mean, I'm still pissed off at WB for Birds of Prey.
Oh yeah.
God damn it.
I remember
such potential.
Remember when that was on, and I think I was still too young and knew enough about Birds of Prey themselves to realize what I was watching until next thing you know it's canceled. I'm like, oh well, that's in a way I was like, well, I didn't get into it too much, so it hurt less.
Yeah, huge potential in that, and they just ruined it completely. Like, what is this crap? Yeah, so.
I've been hearing the same thing about Gotham.
I'm liking Gotham.
Yeah, I like it enough to keep watching it. Gotham, they're trying really hard to be gritty, and that's kind of where they're teetering on fail right there. But
yeah.
these newer episodes are starting to get a little bit better, you know. But they're trying hard to, you know what I mean, to be cool and to be gritty and, you know.
Be truthful to the mythos while understanding that, well, I mean, we're a TV show. We got to do things differently.
Exactly. Yeah, it was I've seen up to, I want to say, episode 4 or 5 so far.
I've only seen clips, so.
Yeah, watch the first 2 episodes and then, you know, and get a judgment off of there. It's good. I'm going to tell you who steals the show is Penguin. The guy they have playing Penguin.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
He's so much fun to watch.
Yeah, phenomenal. Like, he literally he steals the cake. You know, he just steals the show. So, he's fun to watch. The guy playing Gordon is, you know, he's Gordon. You know, he does. He's a young Gordon, basically. You want to think.
You're empathetic toward him. You know he's, you know, he's gonna do good.
Right.
I mean, there's no questions about him, but he's the driving force.
Yeah, you got to think pre-Batman Year One, basically, is what's going on.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
And
so
I read that one, and and it's like, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I also read, the Jack Kirby Batman, and, like, after reading, I read that first back in high school, and then read Year One, and it's like, I don't know how to balance this. Because, like, on one, it's like, we have Batman who literally punches out Superman because it's like, Batman is sick and tired of Superman.
Right, right.
And then you have, like, Batman when he's just starting out.
Yeah, I admit, I'm a bad Batman fan because I have not read Year One yet. I've watched the animated movie.
I
have the animated movie, so.
I watched the movie and then the comic.
See, that's what's going to end up happening for me. I'll just go back and read the comic, but,
depending on when you started, because for me, as far as enjoying comics regularly, that's only been, like, the last 2 years for me. And not because I didn't like comics before, but it's just that, just as it is now, it was intimidating back then to go, oh, well, there's 60 years worth of comics? Where do I start? And it's like, and Wikipedia just makes it so much easier. It's like, I'll just read Wikipedia page and find out what's going on.
Yeah, I started out pretty young, but I didn't even think, you know, I just picked up what looked cool, you know, and just kind of went from there and collecting. But, like, I stopped collecting because they kept coming out with more and more titles, more and more series, and I just couldn't keep up anymore. And as an artist, I just started following other artists that I like and, you know, just pick up whatever they're working on because I just could not follow all the stuff that they're doing.
I think if it wasn't for what they did with 52, at least DC Comics wise, I think I would be a lot more lost. Like, when those 52s came out, that's when I could start, okay, if they're starting over, maybe I can pick up something from this point on. Mm-hmm. And that's been a little easier. I mostly wait for, like, collected editions to come out before I start reading something again.
Yeah.
Just because then, I'll get lost and find out I don't know where to go.
Yeah.
That's what my problem is, re-getting into Marvel Comics right now. And I think more or less I like them more, but I'm also susceptible to getting more lost while I'm trying to read them. So I have to read this other comic book to find out what's going on in the next one? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the flowchart?
Yeah, they've always done that, man. It's just
I've been a Dark Horse and all the other lesser known titles.
Yeah,
because, like, the first thing, like, in high school, before high school, I'd go to a comic shop and pick up, like, the Archie Sonic comics.
Right,
and this was back when they referred to Doctor Ivo Robotnik before, like, the entire, like, incorporating the Japanese timeline. And then, like, in high school, it's like someone recommended Sandman to me.
Hmm.
And I sat and was like, what's this? Sandman, sat down, read it, and was like, I literally powered through the entire series in a week, and I was sitting there dumbstruck. I'm like, this was a comic book?
Yeah. Hey, Neil Gaiman, man, that's all I can say. It's just, you know, so, yeah, Sandman intimidates me. Like, I think I maybe got halfway through issue one and just put the book down and backed away. I was like, this is
a lot. Oh, God.
Now
I need to look this up because I can't relate to that. I got to find Sandman by Dark Horse Comics? Or is that just a different one altogether?
Sandman was Dark Horse Comics. No. DC had to create its own division just to publish Sandman, and I can't remember what they put it under.
I have to look that up.
Valiant, yeah.
Yeah, it was Valiant.
Yeah. And then Valiant decided to say, hey, DC, guess what? You guys.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's Neil Gaiman, so, I mean, of course they're going to give him his own, like, you know, offshoot, you know, as far as publishing goes, because that it's going to be huge with Neil Gaiman.
And on top of that, I think it was the first and only Pulitzer Prize winner for a comic book. And then they rewrote the rules to exclude comic books because of it.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't hear about this.
Apparently, it was so well written, given the author, that they had to give it the award. The only problem was that a lot of the old types were like, this is comic
book. Yeah, a lot
this
of
is
old
a comic
purists.
Book. This
yeah.
is child stuff. And, when you actually sit down and read
no,
it,
it's
like,
pop.
No.
Yeah. Well, it's pop culture. It's just kids stuff. No, it's not. This is...
It deals with some serious issues.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I'm still to this day a little intimidated by Sandman. Should I pick this up and finish reading issue one, maybe?
I would recommend finishing, the first arc.
Mm-hmm.
Just arc one. That will give you the setup for all the rest, but I think... Because, since I read through the entire one, the most heart-wrenching is basically the final arc.
Mm.
And I'm not going to say why, because it's a huge deal.
Mm.
And it's just the way the artist did it and Gaiman wrote it, it literally just pulls your heart out and does... This is your heart.
Yeah, squeezes it. Yeah.
This is what you're feeling right now.
Yeah, squeeze the blood right out of your heart. And
just before
yeah.
you pass out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, those are good stories, though. But, yeah, the writers like those guys, you can't ignore them. You know, you have to.
They're one in a million.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, he's constantly writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I have, several of his short story books.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm flipping through them, what? What? What?
Yeah, he's right up there with the Watchmen author writer.
Can't remember his name right now, but yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't get brought up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows about Watchmen?
Yeah, but he's done a bunch of other stuff, but he's at that level to where it's just globally. It's influenced the industry just on a global level because just how good it is and everything. So,
is that the kind of comics that got you thinking that you wanted in on it?
No, I looked up to the guys who were coming out of Marvel in the late '80s. So McFarlane, Silvestri, Jim Lee, those guys. Their art style is what really grabbed me as a kid. Just made me want to. Be a comic book artist because when I started reading, it was Jim Lee working on Uncanny X-Men. McFarlane was doing Spider-Man at the time. They had Silvestri working on Wolverine, and their art style just kind of just threw me for a loop. It's just nothing like it, So, and then when guys like Michael Turner came around kind of in the later 90s and stuff, just that sealed the deal for me. And they went on to do their own thing. They broke away from Marvel and started their own publishing company just so they can do what they wanted to do in comics. Just do what they wanted and not have that Marvel DC leash around their neck. They just kind of
curse and blessing it can be.
Yeah, of course, Marvel is a springboard. Was a springboard for them because without Marvel, who knows when they would have become known or got out there. So, but. Yeah, that's what made me want to get into it. And
and things are different nowadays. When they started, they probably couldn't simply start on their own, but now we have different ways to publish works and different ways that you can get your own stories, your own art out to other people.
Absolutely. The internet changed all that. The good and bad thing about the internet is that everybody can do a comic book now. Everybody can self-publish. That's a good and bad thing. So, but now, you can just be your own publisher, be, everything, be your own marketing person, another bad thing is now it gives the top threes basically the pick of the litter, back
they,
in...
Yeah. They could probably find somebody like, oh, hey, let's hire you to come do something.
Oh, yeah, you live in the Philippines? No problem. Just scan the pages and email them to us, you know. And before, when I was coming up, you know, thinking of the dream comic book job, but that's back in the days where Marvel and DC had actual artist pits in the studio. You know, they had, like, basically cubicles where all the...
And they had major offices in, like, giant cities, yeah. Like...
Marvel artists, 9 to 5.
Exactly. Like, you know, you... got up and went into the studio every day and, you know, went to your table. You were surrounded by everybody else, all the other artists there, drawing and working on stuff, and editors were there. And then you go home and at night and get up and go do it all over again. And I was like, man, that's awesome, dude, you know. But now everything is downsized and they can work with artists from all over the world, you know what I mean? And there's...
You do page 5, you yep. do page 6...
Like, yeah, this guy can't do it. All. We got fill in. We got a ready pool that just fill in, you know. And I was submitting like crazy. And I think 2007, 2006, I was at Wizard World Chicago. And it was during one of the DC and Marvel's big, basically, talent cattle calls that they do at those shows. Mm-hmm. And I got a call back from both of them, you know, from DC and Marvel. And basically, you just go in there and you meet one with whatever editor they had there at the time, and he flips through your portfolio and gives you some pointers, tells you what he wants to see you work on and improve, and slides you his business card, basically, and tells you to keep in contact. And I did that, but nothing ever came of it. And what would have happened is they would have put me in the ready pool, basically, you know, of guys that they could call or contact to fill in on backgrounds or fill in on covers or something like that. But nowadays, it's all about who you know, as far as working for any of the big three, you know, on a Marvel book or a DC book or whatever. So it's even harder for writers to get in, you know. But so after about 5-6 years of just continually submitting stuff to Marvel and Top Cow and all that stuff, I was like, you know what, screw this. I'm just going to do it on my own.
Strike it on my own.
Yeah, just do it on my
that
own.
That internet thing.
Yeah. You know, internet got to the point where, yeah, you can just totally self-publish your own stuff, you know, web comics and all that stuff. So, yeah, I just like
digital publishing.
Yeah. And actually, the first work that I got was through Small Press guys and indie guys. You know what I mean? So... I was like, you know what, this is cool. It was pretty easy. I just submitted and, you know, and, yeah, they had me working. So, yeah, I was like, hell yeah, dude, indie is the way to go right now. So, just make it on your own.
So then how and when did Spiral Inc. come into existence?
Spiral Inc. it was always kind of an idea of mine when I set out to start Hood of Cobra. When I was working on the first issue of Hood of Cobra, this was back in early 2012. I had moved out to Phoenix from Wisconsin in 2009. And Hood of Cobra, the first issue, took me, it was roughly 2 years from conception to printed book, you know what I mean? So,
Was that first issue on your own then, or you were working others?
First issue was entirely pretty much, yeah, on my own. I teamed up with Derek Tipton to do the, he came on to do the cover colors for it. But yeah, the whole first issue was all entirely me, and I met both Derek Tipton and Mickey Chaney when we were hanging out at Jesse James Comics in Glendale. He has a long running doodle night that, like, every Thursday of every week, it's local artists and you know, people will come in and just hang out and sketch and work on whatever that they're working on at the time. And that's where I met all those guys. I met Mickey there. I met Derek there. I met my co-writer, J.J. Shelton. I met him there. And with Mickey and Derek, they seen what I was doing with the first issue, because I would bring pages that I was working on for the first issue. And they were kind of looking over my shoulder, checking it out. I was like, yeah. Derek was like, yeah, I'll slap some color on the cover for you. And Mickey was like, yeah, I'll ink it up for you. And after we published the first, after the first book came out, first show we took it to was Tucson in 2012, and sold just under about 30 copies, you know. And for an indie book that's by an unknown artist, you know, hasn't been advertised, nothing like that, to sell 30 copies in the first rip is unheard of, You know what I mean?
So, oh, man, I can't even imagine what you must have felt with that, man.
Oh, yeah. I was kind of in disbelief. You know what I mean? So, I mean, it was just super well received. And
$1 million probably couldn't have changed it.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, because just by comparison, a lot of the indie guys that were, you know, doing the same thing, like local indie guys, they would struggle to sell 5 copies that whole weekend. You know what I mean? And for me to move 30, it's like, you know, mind blown. You know what I mean? So, but it's still humbling. You know, I was never like waving our flag, like, we're freaking
yeah.
awesome.
Yeah. Okay, we have 30 copies.
Yeah.
What's going to happen
next? You didn't stand on top of the convention center and go,
boss! Yeah, no. No, you know, every time I look at my stuff, I see flaws and what can be done better, and you know, how to improve it. But you know, 30 copies is 30 copies for the first show, you know, and that's a little, you know, minor milestone. But after we did that, we were kind of looking at each other, you know, like we should probably make something of this. Like we should probably just give it a go and come up, you know, do our own publishing studio. And yeah, so I mean. Spiral Inc. was born after that, but it was funny because, you know, I've always been the biggest Tool fan. You know, I'm a huge Tool fan, and Spiral was, I came up with that concept after the Tool song Lateralis.
I'm trying to remember that one. I don't think that was one that played on the radio much.
It gets some radio play, but it's just the title song from that album, and it's always been like a big inspiration to me, and the whole concept is a spiral. It once it started, it just continues, it goes on and on forever, and you know, you never know where it could take you. So it's just, you know, so that's what the ink nib under the over the spiral means. So yeah, just,
that's cool. Yeah, oh, inspiration. I love tying things into song titles, so mm-hmm. I mean that's really cool.
Yeah, the whole, all the times I've been, you know, drawn and set out to start, you know, on my journey to become a comic book artist, Tool was always playing in the background, you know, because I've just been a huge Tool fan, so.
The last time I heard they were in town was like a year and a half, 2 years ago. Did you go to that one?
They were in Phoenix earlier this year. I think that was back in March.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't hear about that.
The U.S. Airways Center in downtown. And I needed that so bad, because the last time I seen them live was 2009, when they were here last time, you know. And, yeah, it's, yeah, you know, We can, that'd be a whole nother interview.
I haven't seen their shows. They're one of those shows that I know I need to see, because I just by what they put out, you know, digitally and through their song, it's got to be an experience.
Yeah, you have to experience Tool. It's just it's nothing like it. You know, it's and the way you can judge a band if they're good or not is to hear them live, and they are
right?
So crisp. It's like listening to their CD. That's how clean it is. You know, it's unbelievable. You know what I mean? So, yeah. But every time I go see them, it's like having a religious experience. Like,
I'm that's good to know. I am of the opinion that if... I feel like most bands can do okay live. That, like, we're already there. If you're entertaining enough, we're at least going to be happy there. I think I've only seen only one band that I've ever seen live that I wanted to walk away from. That was Scars on Broadway. That's the only band that, like, I went there. I was already there. They were playing and tuned out. Was talking to other people next to me. I had never done that before and haven't done it since that way.
Yeah, the only other band that the band that I've seen live that they sound like their CD too and even better is Rage Against the Machine.
Oh.
But this was back when they were doing their Audio Slave thing with Chris Cornell. You know,
I would have loved to have seen that.
And you know, I love Audio Slave. Like, the stuff they did with Chris Cornell was awesome. You know, but what was so awesome about the show is that halfway through the show, for like the intermission, Chris leaves stage. He's like, "I'm gonna take a break, but these guys want to play some stuff for you." Leave stage, and they just immediately bust into their Rage stuff. I was like. Like, it was awesome, man. I'll never forget that concert, dude. It was just amazing.
Do they still tour? If they do, I gotta find them at some point.
Rage, like, they'll do tours, like, if they're asked to do them. Like, they're not, they'll do concerts if you're asked to do them.
Can we start putting money in a hat then?
Really, yeah. Because, you know, I heard that for them to show up for a show, it's like $1 million or something like that. So,
oh, I'm sure everyone, right?
Yeah. If everyone chips in a dollar.
$2, everybody, we got it.
got it, yeah. Start a Kickstarter for that, you know, so. But,
well, it probably wouldn't be the first time.
No, no. But, yeah, so that's kind of where the influence came from.
I like what you said earlier when we were talking about how the Marvel Studios and DC Studios worked back in the day, where it was that group thing,
mm-hmm.
and how we've gone away from that, but you just finished telling me that Spiralinks came from that group think.
Yeah.
That group think idea, where people working together in the same place.
Just, all local guys, too, yeah. It's just... Yeah.
Linked up like Legos, and you had a Lego Millennium Falcon all of a sudden.
Yeah. Well, the thing that attracted me to Derek's work and Mickey's work was just the level of detail that they were doing, and you know, just that quality that was there. And you know, those are two guys that just put 110 in what they're doing, and it showed. You know, just the talent shown through, and you know, just by comparison to what else I've seen locally. You recognize the guys that are kind of top tier compared to people who are just kind of, you know,
amateur hobbyists
and stuff like that. Another thing that, you know, that made me want to work with them is because we all shared the same kind of work ethic. You know, we were all about, you know, putting the work in, putting the time in to get, you know, the highest quality stuff. And see, with Spiral, we're our whole, like, motto is, you know, quality over quantity. A lot of indie guys out there, they'll put out a bunch of stuff that's kind of, it's okay.
Hoping that something sticks?
Yeah, hoping that something sticks, and it's all right, but no single one of their titles is just phenomenal, something that they just put 100% in, you know. So I was like, you know, I don't want to stray away from that, you know. We want to put in 110% in the one or two titles that we're doing. So it'd just be the absolute best stuff that we can put out at the time.
Actually, this is getting me thinking. Like, in the comic book industry and just about everywhere else, there's someone that you look at their work and you're wondering, like, how the hell are they famous? Is there anyone?
Rob Liefeld.
There we have a name. They network right, apparently. I think I know that name. Captain America, the chest cover,
yeah.
Oh my god, the
infamous Captain America chest cover.
Oh
yeah.
My god.
Yeah.
How?
Oh. Oh man, yeah. It's
talk about anatomy failure.
He's notorious for it too. Like, he's notorious for being horrible, but for being a mainstream horrible comic book artist. But he's a household name in the comic book industry. You know Rob Liefeld. You know, but it's one of those things. You know, and. Everybody has their opinion about the stuff. I'm not knocking his fans for, you know, his followers and stuff. I mean, everybody's opinionated, but it's like, hey, I don't get it, you know. And I'm an artist, so I'm jaded when it comes to the stuff that I think is quality and stuff. But I just, wow,
man. It's on an entirely different level.
Yeah, I think what happened with him is he coattailed or like piggybacked on Jim Lee and Silvestri and McFarlane and stuff. He was in with those guys when they left Marvel, and they all started Image, and I think Rob Liefeld just kind of rolled that wave, because by skill level comparison, he should not have been in that group, but, you know, it is what it is, but that's just my opinion. Can't knock him. He had got the following, and he's consistent with his style. You know what I mean?
He's the one with the quick career, right? I guess he's doing something, right?
Yeah. Everybody's got to be known for something, but it's just, you know, highly stylized, but you can't give an anatomy class on Rob Liefeld's stuff, because you just, you know, will not compute, basically. So.
Something is not right.
Yeah, and it's a lot of guys, a lot of fans anyway, in the comic book world that just, they're hobbyists just to pick on Rob Liefeld.
Probably another byproduct of the age of the internet.
Funniest Rob Liefeld story I have is from Tucson Comic Con last year when he was there. And it's just one of those things that the timing of this was perfect. As, he was at his table signing autographs and stuff, and some guy walked up that was next in line, and Rob was asking him what did he want a sketch of. And some random guy walking past was like, "Why don't you draw him some fucking pouches, Rob?" It was just perfect, and he got all like mad. He was looking up, looking around to see who said that. It was just It was hilarious. Hilarious.
And that probably dropped him a couple of pegs. Oh, that's right. I'm guessing there were some people probably waiting in line that, like, as soon as they were done, they were looking for that.
Oh, man. Like, well, no, some of them were laughing, too. Like, just like, little group of laughter just exploded. Like, you couldn't help it because it was so funny. So funny. So, yeah, that's what he's known for, pouches. Pouches everywhere.
You know, speaking of anime, one of the things that really popped out from what I was seeing from your work is that you seem like Spiral Comics is very forward of how they're drawing the characters, and what they're trying to express in the comics, both visually and story wise. What's behind that?
Just some of my artistic influences and just the guys that I really admire their art style and the way they draw anatomy. I like really highly detailed stuff, and like with characters on the page, I think if you keep their anatomy pretty close enough, like true enough to real life with body expressions and stuff like that, and mostly proportionate features and stuff, I think it really gives a little a different dynamic element to it. But yeah, working on anatomy is always a work in progress. But yeah, as far as style wise, I like to keep the characters, strong looking, but not overly comic booky like you would see in something like Image or, you know, like even Marvel with, you know, the guys who have the huge bodies and little heads and stuff. Yeah.
I mean, without a doubt, I mean, the characters that I was looking at through your sketches and the comics, I mean, sexy. I mean, they're sexy.
Yeah. Yeah, they have to keep a certain level of appeal to them. I mean, both the males and the females. I think a lot of times they push the females more than they do the guys, you know, and to sell the books. And I'm like, well, if your main character is a guy, he needs to look as, you know, just as appealing as the females do.
For the female audiences.
Yeah, for any kind of female reader that'll come along, or for the readers that like guys, you know, that, you know, you're,
we know there's plenty, you know, of both.
Yeah. So it's, but yeah, I'm of that mindset that, you know, they both need to be as equally attractive, you know, and just dynamic looking to where, physical, the body language is what we communicate most with anyway, as human beings. Like, you can tell exactly what's going on with somebody just by looking at them.
Yeah, there's always those statistics about, like, such and such percentage of communication is body language.
So, yeah, it's like 90% of it is body language, you know. So, you know, from the facial features, the eyes, to posture, how they're standing, hand gestures, you can get a sense of what's going on with that person just from their body language, you know. So I try to incorporate that in my artwork, and sometimes it works out, sometimes not so much, but, you know, it's always a work in progress. But I'm trying to lean away from the really over exaggerated comic book, you know, anatomy. That's yeah.
Here's a punch, and then here's the other one where it's like zoom in on the fist, yeah. And then like all in, like where the shoulder is, like
it's like it's fun to look at, but it's like, you know, me, I come from a martial arts background, and when I look at fight scenes in comic books, I'm like, what just happened? Like, what
did he dislocate his shoulder just to throw the punch?
Yeah, and they'll twist his spine like 180 degrees to try to show the power of this punch. And I was like,
you just twisted his back right up.
Yeah, like if he twisted his torso that way, he would be dead from twisting his spine in half. So. Yeah, it's just, with action sequences and stuff in the books, I just try to make it, you know, be as fluid and make as much sense as possible. But I try to stay away from, you know, adding veiny muscles and, like, just impossible muscle structure on the heroes. Like, their veins have veins and stuff like that. Like
embellishments.
Yeah, like, all those, like, yeah, this guy is just super ripped and jacked and, you know, he has no fatty tissue whatsoever under his skin. It's just skin on top of, you know, super ripped muscles and stuff. But, you know, that stuff is fun to look at. But, you know, yeah, for what I draw in particular, I try to
that's
keep
really it, admirable. Yeah,
I try to keep a little bit of believability into it. So, you know, because I think that over-exaggerated stuff has just flooded the comic book scene.
Yeah,
the market,
and,
you know?
I mean, it's and I think I use the word admirable, and I think it's really true, because we just talked about earlier how you really believe in quality.
Mm-hmm.
And
you being an indie publisher, it's I can only imagine you have to kind of second guess yourself, see why am I doing this? Am I doing this for the artwork, for the quality of work, or am I doing this, you know, for the, you know, scraps of attention that I'm hoping to get?
Yeah, and I had the same conversation with a friend of mine last night. Is that doing comic books and like being, you know, drawing comic books, it's really a selfish kind of endeavor, because you have to, as an artist, you have to draw the stuff that you like. You know, I draw for me first, and I have to like it. I have to be pleased with it in order for me to want to share it with anybody else.
It's your passion.
Yeah. So, you know, I draw the stuff that I like to see. And just draw what I like, because ultimately I'm the only one that's going to be able to please me, you know. And usually that's hard to do, because I'm my worst critic, you know, all the time. And every artist will tell you the same thing, you know, we are our worst critic, you know. And I'll draw something and I'll take a step back and look at it like, this is crap. But somebody else will see it like, man, this is awesome.
What's wrong with you? What are you doing?
Yeah. I'm like, what are you talking about? This is crap. Look at this over here. What about that? You know, but no, they see just a work of art. You know what I mean? So it's just, you know, it's you can't be a people pleaser as an artist. I think a lot of people try that, but it's impossible. You can't please everybody. You know, so I think if I just work to try to please myself and always push myself to be better so I can, you know, be more satisfied with the work that I'm doing, then, you know, I'll stay true to.
I have to imagine, though, that your fans have to at least understand that passion, and I love you for that. I'm mm-hmm. truly believe that, you know, if you're doing something you're really passionate about and you're being true to it,
yeah.
The people who are going to be admirable about it or admire you for it
mm-hmm.
are going to be more appreciated than it's just like a passerby to the medium.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the one thing that people are drawn to the most is when someone is genuine. You know, people love when something is real. You know, it's coming from a real place. I think people are able to sniff out posers and wannabes pretty quickly. You know, so the guys
and the internet is so merciful to people. Like
them,
right?
Oh yeah, no, later, totally merciful.
Nothing happens to them later.
No, yeah, it's I mean, it's. I think anybody that gets into this business, especially, you know, the production of comics, is out of a love for it, you know, out of a passion, because if it's not there, you know, it'll be a short run for you. You know, because it's very frustrating. It's very labor intensive. You know. Just full of that kind of stuff. So if you don't really love it, like really love comics, you know, producing it, writing it, drawing it, whatever you're doing, you're just not going to last, because there are some days where I sit down at the table and I just feel like jamming that pencil in my freaking neck and being done with it, you know what I mean? So, but yeah, it's a labor of love, you know, it's a passion, and I do it because I can't help it. It's just, you know, it's what I do, it's what I want to do, you know, it's just... That's all it is to it. So,
I don't know if this was written anywhere. I didn't see anything about it, but is your work with Spiral Inc. full time, or did you support it some other way?
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal, is to be full time. But I mean, right now we all have day jobs that we gotta tolerate until we, you know.
We hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm probably the worst of the bunch since I'm still in customer service.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the way of the world, man. I mean, we want to get to the point to where your art is supporting you and you don't have to support your art, you know. So, but in the meantime, yeah, I gotta tolerate a day job, but that's, you know, that's funding this little operation so far. I mean, We have been successful enough so far, like in our first year and a half of being out there, to where, you know, we'll do a show and at the very minimum we're making our costs back. You know, we'll make our table costs back, or, you know, we'll make our travel expenses back.
Nice.
So that in and of itself is a little success marker. You know what I mean? So if we're at least doing that, then that's enough to fuel us with enough hope to keep going and like, okay, you know, if we're doing this much, then we got the potential to do more and more, to where we're slowly clamoring our way to being to the point to where we can do it full time and still make a comfortable living off of it, you know. And are we trying to get rich? No. And I don't think anybody that gets into the comic book business looks, you know, gets into what the dreams of becoming rich and famous one day, because it's highly unlikely, you know. But yeah, we're, you know, we're doing what we can to support it until it does, you know, we get a break and it does get to the point to where we can do it full time, you know, because that's the goal, that's the dream, you know. Eventually, I had plans to rent out, you know, office space. So it'd just be a spiral office space, so where me and Derek and Ruben could just go and to the
for
office
that day,
every day.
You have the name just on a wall.
Go to the office, sit down, and
yeah, go to office, bang out some stuff, and go home at the end of the day. You know, like a 9-to-5 job. I mean, that's a dream. You know what I mean? So, and eventually, you know, I would like to have, you know, get to the point to see, you know, a major motion picture get made out of one of our titles.
Yeah.
You know, like that's. You know, that's awesome. Guys like...
sky's the limit, man.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and that might be a low, you know, some people might say that's, you know, aiming low just to get a movie made. But, like, for me, that's it. You know, like, if I can get that far, mission accomplished.
I can't even imagine
what
that's like.
Yeah, one movie, maybe a video game spinoff, and I'm like, dude, that's it. You know,
you're in the theater, you're seeing your character you made going across the big screen, you're like, whoa!
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I could die.
Worth it.
Yeah.
I did that guy. I made him.
Yeah.
Like, shut up and sit down.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I could die a happy man at that point, man. You know, it's...
Actually, this has got me thinking. Like, what, other than comic books, what else has influenced you?
What movies? You know, movies, graphic novels. Like, I grew up reading a lot of, like, Dungeons and Dragons, too. You know, like, a lot of high fantasy... stuff, sci-fi stuff, but yeah, it's been, you know, comic books and movies, you know, cartoons, you know, that type of stuff. So, but once I really started making, I got old enough to make the connection of, hey, these guys that came up with these movies and comic books, and, you know, they were just normal guys, like, you know, artists and stuff. It was nothing really phenomenal about them. Like, they never really started out famous or anything, and then all of a sudden, hey, now their book has been made into a movie. I mean, and these are, like, independent guys. Like, prime example, James Obart, creator of The Crow. You know, that movie is still a cult, it's like a cult classic now. You know, still a huge following.
I had only just seen that movie, like, 3 or 4 years ago, and yeah.
Started out, you know, that guy, he was an auto mechanic for years. You know, he would work in the shop and come home and work on his comic book and go to work and, you know, just repeat. Same thing I'm doing, you know, just work a 9-to-5 and then come home, work on your comic, and get up in the morning, start all over again. And it was a black and white comic, indie, you know, indie published, and, you know, fast forward a couple of years, and now it's a freaking cult classic, you know, it's, you know, and I'm like, dude, that's awesome right there. You know, I mean, look at Ninja Turtles.
Oh, yeah.
Another. I mean, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That's a household name all over the world. You know, and those guys
from humble beginnings.
Yeah, super humble. I mean, black and white sketches. You know what I mean? And the first graphic novel for it, black and white, really just gritty. Black and white just had the epitome of indie comic book.
And I haven't read those comics before, but they all had, like, the same color mask back then too, right?
Yeah,
even, like,
they all wore red. They all wore red masks when they colored the graphic novel. Like, the next year after the first printing came out, they all wore red. They all wore red masks, and they were slicing and dicing dudes. I mean, it was bloody, you know. And
just something that you take for granted that they even, like, just stay with the same color.
Yeah,
just because
wait,
that's
the
what the medium.
Yeah,
didn't the creator of Ninja Turtles also do heavy metal?
I don't know, they might have published this, like, some kind of, like, side story in heavy metal, but I don't, they might have, one of them might have started heavy metal, I'm not sure, I think if not started it, one of them might have bought the magazine. But yeah, I mean, it's guys like that that started from very humble beginnings and, like, just hardcore garage indie stuff.
There's
and
few things that warm my heart as much as Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I remember reading my first reading the first issue of Ninja Turtles back in middle school. Man, it's a black and white comic, and, you know, it fast forward
movies, cartoons.
Yeah, fast forward a couple years later, the cartoon came out, and then, like, a year after that, the first live action movie. I'm like, this is blowing my mind. Like, dude,
I've watched those movies like hundreds of times by now.
Yeah, everybody has. It's you know, very few people at this point, you know, was aware of how that story got started. It was a black and white indie book. You know, nobody knew of it until the cartoon came out, really, and took off from
and
there.
I know a lot of people are upset about like, the new movies that are coming out with, but, I mean, for me, it's like, I have what I had, and I still love that stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, I can still love that. I don't have to love the new stuff. And I haven't even seen the new stuff. I have no opinion on it. But I still got something to love.
Yeah, I saw the new movie a couple weeks ago. I didn't like it. I hated it. It was like, you know, that the fight choreography, the fight scenes were good, but the movie overall is like, ugh, garbage. But
it's better than what the original plan with Michael Bay was.
Yeah, the whole alien concept. No, they
I better remember how so
God.
Angry
they,
people were about
the
that.
The internet blew up after when that idea came out. Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of the hardcore Turtle fans, the first movie will always be, you know, the best one that they came out with. You know,
I still have the soundtrack to that at home.
Oh yeah, I mean, I remember having that thing on cassette tape, dude. That's how old it is.
there was like when I was like three, four, and five. I knew I put that was on repeat in my house all the time.
Mm-hmm.
MC Hammer and everyone else that was on that CD. I still have that. Thanks to Spotify, I have it again.
Yeah.
The dangers of the internet, reliving your childhood memories through music.
So I think for a lot of people, that'll always be like the favorite. You know, so I mean, one of my biggest gripes about the new movie is that they made them entirely too big. You know, why are they 8 feet tall?
They're really big, like, aren't they?
They were gigantic.
The one I only seen the trailer, and like the one trailer has when they reveal Shredder, and I'm sitting there like, since when was Shredder a Transformer?
Right, mech suit trailer, or mech
like
suit
chink.
Shredder. Yeah,
and I'm like.
Yeah.
I'm looking at Galvatron
like
Wolverine claws here.
Yeah, so Shredder wears a mech suit now? Like, what?
Yeah, I blame the anime.
And he's like, you know, he's like firing swords and knives out of his arms and stuff. I'm like, what am I watching?
Independently speaking, out of context, that actually sounds pretty cool. Maybe not so much in the Turtle universe, but...
Given that they made the Turtles, you know, 8 foot tall and bulletproof, you know what I mean? It's like, well, now Shredder has to wear a mech suit to compensate for the size and strength difference, you know what I mean?
Whatever happened to just ducking your head into your shell and dodging cannonballs?
Yeah, where did that concept go? Yeah, that this was completely lost. But you know, it's whatever. There's going to be reboots. They've been rebooting stuff from the '80s for years now. You know, but
considering that Sony's doing it to Spider-Man every other time.
Yeah, they got to pump it out while they still had the movie rights, because in a few more years they lose you know, their licensing. It expires and it goes back.
Those Sony
Marvel,
hacks
so.
Have brought up a lot of info about that, like. Mm-hmm. They're really thinking about letting Marvel have Spider-Man back, from the sounds of it. Or if not, Sony Japan is thinking of making him.
Yeah, I can't see Sony being too happy about letting Spider-Man go. But I mean, if it does go back to Marvel, then it's going to be a whole another reboot for it. You know, so they're
whole another reboot and a possible reintroduction to the Avengers.
Yeah,
which. I'm pretty sure a lot of nerds and geeks are going to be, yeah, that's amazing. But
we
at the
win!
Same time,
we complained
like,
enough!
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, they've already established the Avengers universe already. So
which,
details, come on.
Yeah, which, you know, I'm like, when in the Avengers movies, when the alien invasion happened, I'm like, okay, technically that took place while Spider-Man was around. Where was he? You know,
he was
like,
sick.
It's like right in his backyard, basically, and nobody in the Marvel Universe showed up. Like, where were the X-Men? Like, they just happened to miss a huge alien invasion taking place in downtown Manhattan or wherever it was. I'm like,
Fantastic Four. What
yeah,
about
where were they at? You know, so it's yeah. But if they get that they get that license back, it's going to be a whole another, you know, a third Spider-Man reboot, basically. So.
The rumors I did hear is that Marvel doesn't intend, though, to do another origin story if they get him back. So they'll skip that and they'll just assume, okay, you guys seen this like a million times.
Yeah.
We're good.
Yeah, let's just throw him in there.
Yeah.
Know, so, right.
We'll make some kind of excuse to say, like, this is why he didn't show up during these events.
Yeah, he was knocked unconscious from a previous fight. And
hopefully it'll just be a short exposition. Thor's going like, so how did you get your powers? Spider bite?
Yeah.
Radioactive.
Yep.
What?
Bit by
spider.
Total accident.
And then Captain America jumps off another plane.
Yeah. Yeah. No parachute. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about you had three different series under your Spark Comics?
Yeah, we have three titles so far. Hooded Cobra, Dark Light, and Succubus. So,
Cobra is the one that you worked on, that you started with, right?
Yeah, Cobra is the one that we started out with, and then Derek did Dark Light about a year later, and then Succubus is our new title, which is just like a little fun side project that I do, porn comic, just for fun, just because we can, basically. But, Hooded Cobra is, a story about RJ. He's Hooded Cobra. He's an agent for an ancient secret society called the Den of Serpents. And he's tasked with the mission of hunting down five exiled members who are trying to reduce the world's population by over 70% with one big global event.
So, it's kind of a lot of people.
Yeah, so it's a pretty heavy plot.
What was the name of the organization again? Was it, I just loved hearing that name.
Den of Serpents.
Such a good name.
Yeah.
Well done.
Hooded Cobra and the Den of Serpents. It's I drew from a lot of ancient Sumerian mythology, and that whole everything that goes along with that. I mean, the story goes that there was a organization called the Brotherhood of the Snake that was supposedly the very first secret society ever, in human civilization. So they were kind of like the secret society that all secret societies kind of stem from.
Primeval sort of
yeah.
thing.
Well, they weren't evil. They were just, they had the task of keeping sacred knowledge sacred and kind of, guarding that sacred knowledge and only giving it to humans that were, worthy of knowing, the sacred knowledge. And then they kind of got, slandered, their name got slandered into being the bad guys, and the whole image of the serpent got turned into a bad symbol or like an evil symbol. So I kind of drew from that whole element. And in the story, the Den of Serpents is basically the originator of all secret societies. Like, all secret societies kind of can be traced back to the Den of Serpents because they've been around for just that long. And the whole thing is that they kicked out these five exiled members who, they kicked them out because these were the guys who were kind of...
Extremists?
Extremists. They wanted to rule humans, and they were all with the tyranny, basically. They wanted to control everything, and they kicked them out because, these guys, their idea was that, we need to control the humans and use them, and use them as they were intended, was basically slaves for us. And it's easier to control 600 million than it is 6 billion. So if we knock that number down a little bit, we can free up a lot more resources for ourselves and, live like kings again, basically, and, have a lot more of the Earth's resources for us and all that stuff. So, but if you you do your research, you can kind of find that whole theme kind of going on today in real life, with the whole... population control ideas and stuff like that. And so we used or I used a lot of carefully hand-picked conspiracy theories to kind of throw in there. And,
oh, nice. Oh, I love that stuff.
Just
enough little facets of the real world to make you think a bit.
Yeah, because I mean, the truth is far more interesting than made-up stuff, and when you dig, if you dig enough and find out little bits and pieces, it's enough to do 3-4 stories on, so.
Have you heard, because I read something that if all of humanity lived in an area that was as dense as New York City, we could all fit in Texas.
Yeah.
I read that. That was the most amazing thing.
Yeah, the whole human population could fit in the area the size of Texas, basically, and it's more or less true, but most people can't fathom that because, we all have been brainwashed to think that, more is,
we have to have a certain amount of space.
Yeah, excess is, we just live in the land of excess, and But really, if we resource our environment and our living space right, every person could be living in a space of 170,000 square feet, you know, for per person.
It's logistics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
proper logistics.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it, because the powers that be and how everything kind of panned out over the course of history, especially with the social class system in place. You know.
People don't like change.
Well, yeah, they're taught not to like change. They're taught to resist change. But, you know, change can be good, you know, especially if it's, you know, just to pool our resources better and just live life better, you know what I mean, than what we're, because we're really wasteful right now with the way that we're doing it currently.
Does the comic touch on these kind of things?
Yeah. Basically, well, with this first volume, it kind of goes into the story of how the Den of Serpents is tied to the origins of humanity and how once the factions broke off and started warring with each other, everything kind of went to hell for humans, because the whole premise is that that humanity was created as a slave race, basically, to mine for... to work for the race of beings that came down and to the planet for it, to mine for resources, basically.
This is reminding me of Lovecraft right now.
Yeah, well, little, I mean, it has little bits and pieces of, I mean, it's all centered from ancient Sumerian mythology,
yeah.
You know, so I pulled a lot from there, and but it touches on a lot of that type of stuff of how we've been, about how humanity has been manipulated over the years by the evil guys from the Den of Serpents, the ones that were kicked out. You know what I mean? Like how they gave humans the rudimentary knowledge to create the first atom bomb. You know, like the whole premise of how we had help in developing that technology, and not help from other people, like help from, you know,
from on high, superior forces.
From a superior or a more advanced race that came down here and helped us with developing technology. You know what I mean? And so, like, little elements like that, and like mentioning the carefully handpicked conspiracies that we kind of are inserting into the story. RJ Hood of Cobra, he's basically an ex-black ops guy that went rogue when he found out that that the U.S. government is really crooked, you know. So that pissed him off and was like, you know, I'm done. So he kind of went AWOL. And but one of the things that he did in his previous military life is he was part of the demolition team that was responsible for 9/11.
Ooh,
you know, so
nice.
He has,
way to go deep.
Yeah, he has that whole guilt that he's dealing with and struggling with, and that's part of his motivation to joining the Den of Serpents, so he can kind of correct the wrongs that he felt he's done against humanity, working for a corrupt government and stuff. So he hooks up with the Den of Serpents, which when we do an issue zero, it goes deeper into his particular origin and how he actually got linked up into the Den of Serpents and how he becomes Hood of Cobra.
But, so that's definitely something to stay tuned for.
Yeah,
issue zero sort of thing.
Yeah, but he mentions that in issue three.
Oh.
You know, issue three. The guy that he kind of breaks one of his key witnesses that he needs to, talk to about what's going on. He asks him about his past, and you know, Colbert just mentions that, you know, in a previous life I was part of a demolition team responsible for 9/11. Now that in and of itself is still a big conspiracy, because you got the 9/11 truthers and you got the people who believe the official 9/11 report that came from the government. So, you know,
just a sprinkling of
just that little mental time, you know, mental time bomb right there. It's like, all right, now you got to be forced as a reader to pick a side, what side you choose to believe. Here's this guy saying that, hey, I was part of the demolition team that pulled it off, you know. So it's like, and then the guy that he's talking to in the story is like, wait a minute, so you're trying to tell me that 9/11 was, you know,
inside job.
And Colbert just cuts him off right there. Like, I told you, you only get two questions. That's it. That's all I'm saying. You know. So
nice. Well done, sir. Well done.
Yeah.
So, oh man. Yeah. And that's just Hooded Cobra.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah. That's all in Hooded Cobra. So we're
and Dark Light and Succubus are the other titles you have.
Dark Light is Derek Tipton's title. It's like high fantasy, sci-fi fantasy. Got a little bit of steampunk elements mixed into it. And he has a really cool manga, heavily manga influenced style.
Mm-hmm.
That story is about basically You got the realm of dark and the realm of light about to have a big battle with each other. And this this human kid kind of gets inadvertently mixed in with it. He's at the wrong place at the right time, and he discovers the dark light artifact that gives the owner immense power and the, you know, the power to defeat either realm. You know what I mean? So they're all hunting him down, trying to get that the dark light realm from him. And nice. Everything. So, yeah.
And I read a little bit on Succubus. I mean, literal Succubus.
It's the story of Zemina. That's her name. She's a real life succubus, and basically, she's the opposite of what succubus are believed to be, which are, you know, evil and malicious, and, you know, they're, you know, horns and the whole thing. And not her. She's a good succubus. She just enjoys being a succubus. So, you know, she's a webcam model by day and a rock star. Stripper by night. So she works at this small strip club called the Velvet Teacup, and she brings in, you know, like record number crowds every night that she's the feature. And her powers are, she's able to manipulate pheromones, you know, that, you know, so she can attract men, women, who's ever, you know, attracted to women, basically, to her. She can manipulate their pheromones and just get pretty much make them so overcome with, you know, lust and desire that she can just, you know, once she has sex with them, they're basically her puppets, you know. So, but does she take advantage of that? Not really. I mean, in this first issue, we just kind of introduce you to her and her personality and everything, and just what she does
within that universe. It's done out of a necessity more than anything else. It sounds
right.
Like
she with her being what she is, she needs to consume sexual energy, sexual like body fluids and that type of stuff to. Just the same way that people need to consume food and water to survive. So without that, she can kind of, you know, wither away and deteriorate and die. And one of the things that I did differently with her is most succubus, when you look up images of succubi, they always have a tail,
horn, tail.
Like, you know. She has a tail, but it's a tattoo. You know, it's a tattoo on her back that moves around and interacts according to her mood, just like a real tail would, but it just kind of moves all over the place.
That's
around
interesting.
Her body. Yeah.
So is this title like an action title, or?
It's going to have some action. And I mean, the second issue is when the actual story plot starts. The first issue is just about, you know,
introduction.
Well, it sounds like it's a big building. It's a big universe to introduce.
Yeah. Well, she's inserted. She's going to be in the spiral universe that we're working on building up. Dark Light happens within the spiral universe, but that's kind of going on. That takes place in a different realm, not necessarily the reality that Hood of Cobra and Succubus takes place in. But Succubus is very much placed in the same reality that Hood of Cobra is in. You know, it's all taking place in like real world, you know, Earth time, that type of thing. So, but. Yeah, first issue it's just fun, just her interacting with people in the club and the people that she knows, and it really has just like a porn plot, you know, like, you know, the whole, oh, your car is broken, let's have sex. Oh, you need that sink fixed, let's have sex. Did you order?
Here's a peanut butter jar.
Yeah, Did you order this pizza?
Somewhere,
let's have sex.
Yeah. I just have to say that. The pizza.
So it's just. Just straight porn logic through the whole first issue, you know, just having fun. And I started this book just to give myself a break in between doing Hood of Cobra titles, you know, because Cobra is just hardcore action comic, you know, espionage, intrigue, action, alien tech, all that stuff. So to give myself a break from that, you know, I just did a fun little sexy title just to do it, because, I mean, I've been collecting, you know, porn comics since I was 14, man, you know, so something that I've always kind of been drawn to. What boy is it, you know? So, and if you claim that you're not, you're in denial, you know? So,
I don't have porn comics.
Yeah, not,
yeah.
Types of porn.
Yeah, you might not have them, but if someone threw them in your lap, you wouldn't, you know, you can't say that you wouldn't flip through
it. Yours sounds interesting, that's for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, they're, you know, all the web is saturated with, you know.
Oh yeah, well, internet.
And you're either, you know, yeah, you're either into it or you're not. But, you know, we don't force it on anybody. And if you're a comic book fan and you're human, at some point in time you would have read a porn comic or a porn web comic or something, you know, because it's just, it's normal. But I've always liked them. They've always been fun, and you know, especially when you get the, you come across the higher art quality ones that, you know, the art really pops and everything. So oddly enough, Succubus just happens to be my first full color comic book that I've done.
So, oh, nice.
It's just, and it wasn't intentional, it's just how it turned out. So
you never know what you're going to find when you start exploring.
Yeah, I mean, and like I said, it was just, you know, something to do out of fun, just in between, you know, doing Cobra stuff, and you know, but it's, again, it's been well received, and the colorist Frederico Socia, he's out of the Philippines, and nice. He colored that whole book, and that, he did such an awesome job on that cover that it literally stops people in their tracks when they're walking past our booth. You know, that cover just pops, and they just walk right up staring at Sucky.
Agreed.
It was like, go ahead, you know, you look like you're of age, you can check it out and everything. But so I and we did a small print run. Actually, I think my copies won't survive the weekend. I think I'm down to like my last three physical copies.
This is good news for you. Congrats.
Yeah, but yeah, so I mean, again, it's been well received. We do have I did put the digital version out first before the printed comic came out, so the PDF and the comic book reader file is out there for, you know, for orders and everything.
But, so if someone wants to read your comics, they can get it digitally, from the sounds of it, from where?
Succubus. Yeah, they can. Succubus is available digital format, and they can order that through emailing us, spiralingcomics.info@gmail.com. Also, just going to our website, spiralingcomics.com, where we know we're on Facebook. You know, for obvious reasons, we haven't really pimped that to the comic book shops. You know, this is something that you either have to catch from us at a show or just order from us directly. You know,
makes sense.
So, because a lot of comic book shops are kind of, you know, fuzzy about putting a porn comic out there. But I mean, they do. I just haven't taken the time to research who's doing it and who's not, because with the internet, it's really of no consequence. You know, we just sell that on our own. It's no big deal.
I know some comic book shops have a little back corner that's sealed that says, yeah, you have to be 18, yeah, or older to enter.
Yeah, I know when Atomic Comics was around, they had a little adult comic section in the back store, in the back of the store and stuff. So
the last comic shop I was in was ABC Comics, and I think that, I'm not sure if it's still open, but that was over in Tempe.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a small corner that said, mm-hmm, 18 or older to, yeah, enter, and the counter was right, one of the counters, yeah, was right next to it. So.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way to keep it secure.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much universal, because a lot of the shops that I went to back when I was living in the Midwest, they just had an 18 over short box or long box, you know, of the comic titles that, or the adult titles that they had. And you just had to ask for it, you know, at the counter. And then pull it out and, you know, there you go. But
flip the red.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's cool, but we'll do fine just selling it directly through us and stuff like that. So it's not a big deal. But again, I mean, it's taking off pretty good. I mean, people are asking about issue 2 already and stuff like that. So yeah, it's
congratulations.
Cool. Yeah, appreciate it, yeah. So we're just having fun, man, doing what we want to do and doing the stuff that we like to do. That's kind of the whole point of why we started our own publishing company. So we don't have to answer anybody, as long as we keep it legal and, you know, don't get ourselves in trouble that way, you know, with the content anyway. Yeah, we can, sky's the limit. We can do whatever we want to do. You know, so.
Well, Rob, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about this. This was fascinating. I mean, only word I can choose is
no, yeah,
for that.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. I appreciate the invite for the interview and everything, and you know, anything we can do to kind of get ourselves out there and, you know, kind of crawl above the, you know, make our way through the maze of being an indie publisher, because, you know, it's a bunch of guys out there and a bunch of stuff out there, and, you know, we're just trying to put our little flag up there, let people know that we're out here. So.
And your booth is still going to be available tomorrow, right? I might come by and pick up some issues.
I'll be there. Derek won't be able to make it down tomorrow, but yeah, we'll be there for the last day of the show tomorrow.
Cool.
And it's been a great show so far for the first year, and I think a lot of people are starting to, you know,
warm up
and just expect to see us at these local shows in Arizona, you know, because we've done a lot of them. I think we're right around doing 5 to 6 shows a year.
Nice.
I think this one makes our 5th show this year. So yeah, we get out and do the local shows a lot, and when we've done Tucson now, this is our 3rd year doing Tucson. So yeah, but we do need to get some books down in Tucson into some of the shops down there, you know. So we're working on doing that. But yeah, we're doing it, man. We're just trying to get out there, and eventually we'll branch out and get to some more out of state shows, and you know, get on the East Coast and do some shows out there. But right now,
little by little, right?
Yeah, little by little. I mean, right now our biggest obstacle is financial. You know, it's just it's hard to as a small publisher to cover travel costs and table costs to do shows across country. You know what I mean? But eventually, we'll get it going. But yeah, any little thing that we can do to let people know, hey, we're out here and come check us out. You know,
we got something worth sharing.
Yeah, we got some cool stuff, man. Check it out. So, cool.
Well, thank you again. It was a pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure, man. Thanks,
pleasure to talk to you.
Yep.
And I hope to see you at future shows and see your work go out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and spiralingscomics.com was
spiralingscomics.com.
All right, then. Yeah. All right.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. No problem.
This has been a presentation of Front Row Geeks. Adios.